We're in 2 Samuel chapter 21. We're going to start at verse 8. This is a story that I think is best placed right around the summer of 1002 BC. We know that the story begins with a 3-year famine that is really hitting Israel hard. I think that famine is anchored around the sabbatical year that ran from 1004, the fall of 1004, till the fall of 1003 BC, because that's the worst possible combo of three famine years you could get. You lose the crop of the 6th year, there is no crop in the 7th year, and you lose the crop of the 1st year of the next cycle. That's horrendous. And so I think we've actually come to the beginning of the spring of that next year, and they really need some rain to help at least the wheat kind of snap out of it and produce something. David has tracked down the reason for this famine to the killing of a bunch of Gibeonites, possibly 7 of them, by King Saul and I think his sons, before Saul was killed during the Battle of Mount Gilboa. So that's well over 15 years earlier, 16 years earlier. The Gibeonites were a protected people because of a treaty made by Joshua with them 400 plus years earlier. But King Saul blew that treaty off, killed these guys, and now they want judgment against 7 of Saul's surviving sons or grandsons. And so that's what's happening here. Verse number 8 of 2 Samuel 21, the king took the 2 sons of Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, whom she bore to Saul. So these are 2 sons by a secondary wife of Saul that are still alive. Their names are Armoni and another Meribbaal. Not the one that we've been talking about that is the son of Jonathan. And then the 5 sons of Merib, the daughter of Saul, whom she bore to Adriel, the son of Barzillai, the Maholathite. So these would be grandsons of King Saul through his eldest daughter, the woman that David was offered the ability to marry after he'd killed Goliath, but he turned it down and she ended up being married to this guy instead. All these guys would have been a majority age easily, and I think they were probably participants in the atrocities carried out by King Saul against the Gibeonites, and that is why they want them dead. I think the Gibeonites feel that justice would be served for these guys in particular to be dead. So verse 9 says that David gave them into the hands of the Gibeonites, so he allows them to carry out the penalty of execution, which was probably stoning. But in the customs of this day, the body of the executed person was put on display for the rest of the day as a warning to anyone else that might think about engaging in the same thing. So they hanged them on the mountain before he who is, so out in the open, for God and everyone else to see, basically, is what they're saying. The 7 of them perished together. They were put to death in the first days of the harvest at the beginning of the barley harvest. So that means right after Passover was finished in this particular year, because the barley harvest starts the second day of the week after the Feast of First Fruits, which happens during that whole Passover unleavened bread celebration. So we know it's very early in this new year for the Israeli people. Now, like I said, the bodies should have been interred in their tombs before the sun went down on that particular day of execution. But they don't get put in because one of the moms stops it from happening. Verse 10, then Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, took sackcloth and spread it for herself on the rock. From the beginning of the harvest, that's the barley harvest, until rain fell upon them from the heavens. Now, typically, the rains should have already happened and finished for the spring. So it's possible that God sends a special late rain to help the wheat that's out there struggling to at least make something in this particular year. That's what my suspicion is that's being described here, is that God sends this rain and gives a last bit of assistance for the wheat to produce. The barley is probably already burned up. That's a possibility. And so that would have only been days before the rain shows up, and then she would have allowed them to be buried. But it's also possible that what the writer is describing here is that this year was a write-off as well, that no rains came until the next winter months started. So many months later, when they'd put new seed into the ground, and the rains began. So I'm of two minds here as to how this plays out. Either the rains start pretty quickly after the executions and the wheat harvest gets rescued, or the rains don't show up until kind of the normal cycle in the late fall, early winter. And it'll be a whole nother year before they get this harvest. Whichever way it works out, this is how it's described that this mom, the secondary wife of King Saul, was stopping the burials. She did not allow the birds of the air to come upon them by day or the beasts of the field by night. So she's basically out there insisting, leave the bodies where they're at. Don't you try to bury them. But she's having to fight off the scavenger birds all day long. And she also has to watch out for the scavenger animals that come by day and by night. Now, that part of the story makes me suspect that the shorter period is in mind, because it would be tough for her to carry this on for quite a few months. Sooner or later, she has to sleep or pass out from exhaustion, and people might grab the bodies and bury them. So my suspicion is that we're talking about a matter of days that she's carrying this on before the rains will finally come and save the wheat harvest for this particular spring. When David was told what Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, the concubine of Saul, had done, David went and took the bones of Saul and the bones of his son Jonathan from the men of Jabesh-Gilead, who had stolen them from the public square of Bashan, where the Philistines had hanged them on the day the Philistines killed Saul on Gilboa. So you remember this story. When Saul and Jonathan and his brothers were killed on Mount Gilboa, the Philistines took their bodies, decapitated at least Saul's body, but They showed the head of Saul around to the different cities to show that he was definitely dead. But they took the decapitated body of Saul and the bodies of Jonathan and his brothers, and they affixed them to the clay brick walls of Bethshan on the north side of the Jezreel Valley, across the valley from Mount Gilboa, as a means of doing exactly what we talked about earlier, displaying the dead body to say, this is what happens to the enemies of the Philistine people. The people of Jabesh-Gilead, who had been rescued from Nahash the Ammonite by King Saul at the very beginning of his kingdom, and people that may have been related to him, because the Jabesh-Gileadites were the source of some of the women that married those 600 guys in the Benjamite tribe to get it restarted. The Jabesh-Gileadites, for those two possible reasons, came and rescued the bodies. They burned them. They interred whatever was left from that cremation, bones, there at Jabesh-Gilead. So David has left those there for the last 15, 16 years. But now, in a way to kind of close things up here, you know, a little bit of closure for the family of Saul, he goes and brings those bones to Benjamite territory. And then he gathers up the bones of the most recently executed members of Saul's family. And verse 14 says, they buried the bones of Saul and his son Jonathan in the land of Benjamin in Zelah, in the tomb of Kish, his father. Now, Zelah must be very close to Gibeah, but it's where the family tomb is located. So they take all of these bones of all these folks and place them in the tomb, put them at rest. And that seems to finish the story, seems to finish the situation. They did all that God commanded, and after that, God responded to the plea for the land, which means the rains started. And that was talked about the fact that she kept, the mom kept chasing the birds, the wild animals, away from those bodies, wouldn't let them be buried, but wouldn't let the animals have them until the rain started. And so the rains start once the body parts are secured in the tomb. And so that is closure for the family of Saul, and also for the Gibeonites, because they've gone, you know, these 14, 15, 16 years without any type of justice for the loss of their loved ones. Now, I think we have the next event taking a few years later. So David settles back in again to his kingdom work, and that involves interacting with those that are associated with his kingdom. Remember, his kingdom expanded greatly. One of the people groups that he fought with, defeated, and made them tributary was the Ammonites, living over on the east side of not just the Jordan Valley, but on the east side of Gilead, on the other side of the ancient trade route that ran through the Moabite plateau, through the plateau north of there, and then up through the eastern side of the Sea of Galilee, a place that we call Golan today, and then eventually goes up to Damascus. So the Ammonites lived on the other side of that highway. In 2 Samuel chapter 10, verse 1 says, after this, meaning after the Meribbaal story, where Meribbaal starts living at Jerusalem and he's being treated like one of David's own sons, and after the story, I believe, from 2 Samuel chapter 21 as well. So, David gets news that the king of the Ammonites had died. The king's name, we'll find out in a moment, is Nahash. Now, it's possible this is the same Nahash that was causing trouble at the beginning of King Saul's reign, but I suspect it may, in fact, be the son of that original Nahash. And that the original Nahash was fairly aged whenever he caused trouble for King Saul. He died during King Saul's reign, and this guy took the throne. But now he's dead. And David has had treaty arrangements with him, had relationships with him, been receiving tribute from him, and has developed a relationship. And so, let's read it again. After this, the king of the Ammonites died, and Hanun, his son, reigned in his place. So we've got a new king over the Ammonites, a younger man. David said, I will deal loyally, or faithfully, or fairly. It's the word chesed. It's the loving kindness word that we've seen. So David has apparently had a good relationship with the previous Nahash, and he wants to have a similar relationship with the son. I will deal with chesed, with Hanun, the son of Nahash, as his father dealt with chesed with me. So it was a bidirectional relationship between this recent Nahash, the late Nahash, and David. So David sent his servants to console the new king, him, Hanun, concerning his father. So typical interaction between kingdoms. The head of state sends his condolences to the new head of state whose father has just died. I believe that we can put a pretty decent date on this as to being 998 into 97 BC. Now, why do I put that date there? Because this is where we start backdating from the birth and life of Solomon. And so we've got a pretty decent handle on that, I think. So we're talking about just a few years after David has worked things out with Meribbaal and dealt with the whole three-year famine and things of that nature. So David's servants came into the land of the Ammonites. It's a couple of days, maybe 3 days at the most, travel from Jerusalem over to Ammon, which is the capital city of the Ammonites. But the princes of the Ammonites said to Hanun, their lord, do you think because David has sent comforters to you that he is honoring your father? Has not David sent his servants to you to search out the city and to spy it out and overthrow it? So the advisors of the late king start stirring up trouble by telling the new guy, their new king, don't be fooled by David sending you these people with condolences from him. Because what he's really doing is coming over here to find out how he can completely bring us under his heel. Now, as I already said, David is in a tributary relationship with the Ammonites, has been for a while. But at some point, he seems to have developed a fairly decent relationship with the late king Nahash, and that tribute has really been much more like a tax for being part of the larger kingdom of Israel, and that there is positive things that happen because of the paying in of this tribute, the paying in of this taxes. These advisors are trying to convince the new guy, no, you know what's going to happen here is he's going to start treating us as second-class citizens. He's going to start treating us as subjected people, of subjugated people, and he's going to put an occupation force in here, and it's going to be bad. He's going to jack up the amount of money we have to kick in. And we can't let him do that. You gotta be a tough guy. You got to assert independence, is what they're really pushing him for. And so this young man, we don't know how old he is, but he does seem to be younger. He decides, perhaps on these guys' advice, to insult David's representatives. So Hanun took David's servants. He shaved off half the beard of each. Now, I don't know how that worked. I don't know if he like just cut off one side, right or the left, of their hair, their facial hair, or did he just clip off their long beards? It's not been too long ago that we had a little problem in our Amish communities of beard clipping. You remember that? That some Amish group would grab the guy from another Amish group and clip off his beard, you know, as an insult to him. So it's something kind of like that going on here. And it was a horrible insult. And it wasn't just that. It says that they also cut off their garments in the middle at their hips. So it was typical practice when you were grieving the loss of someone, the death of someone, to rip your clothing. You remember that. And so sometimes they would put on special clothing to rip it on purpose as their public demonstration of that. Well, it seems almost as if there is a play on that ceremony here. But what they do is they rip the clothing at the back of these Israeli representatives' clothing so that basically their bottoms are showing. Now, I don't mean naked bottoms. They'll have their undergarments on, but they will no longer be properly clothed in the back. They've ripped and cut them away so that they're sending them away with their underwear showing, if you will, on the backside, and chases them away. Now, that is horrendous. Verse 5, when it was told David, he went to meet them. So David leaves Jerusalem. He goes down to Jericho, where these guys have arrived shamefully. And stayed, because they don't want to come up any closer to Jerusalem. So he went to meet them. He sent to meet them, for the men were greatly ashamed. The king said, remain at Jericho until your beards have grown and then return. So we can fix the clothing issue by just getting new clothes. But the beard problem, that's going to take a few weeks. Now, verse 6. When the Ammonites saw that they had become a stench to David, well, no kidding, they have poked the bear. The Ammonites sent and hired the Syrians of Rehob and the Syrians of Zobah, 20,000 foot soldiers, and the king of Maacah with 1,000 men, and the men of Tob, 12,000 men. So basically, Ammon has decided to rebel against the Israelis. They don't want to pay tribute to them anymore. And so they decide maybe the best way to do this is with some other people that may not want to pay tribute to the Israelis either. So they reach up to all the people that are to the north, you know, in that whole Baca Valley situation that David had captured at the very beginning of his time at Jerusalem. And apparently it works. All of these people sign on to a new alliance to resist David. And Ammonite territory is at the center of it. When David heard of it, he sent Joab and all the host of the mighty men. And the Ammonites came out and drew up in battle array at the entrance of the gate. And the Syrians of Zobah and of Rehob and the men of Tob and Maacah were by themselves in the open country. So the big battle is starting to take place over in the Gilead territory of Israel, which is right on the border with Ammon. And Ammon, Jordan, the modern city of Ammon, Jordan, is where the capital of Ammon was at this time. And so this is a big border war. This is a big rebellion war. It's sedition. It is traitor's behavior. And this is the stage against which David's biggest failure is about to take place. Mark your place here. We'll get back into the Word next time God gives us opportunity.